We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants, and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, the podcast where we delve into the heart of hospice palliative care. My name is Lori Gill, and I am the education specialist at North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, and I will be your host today as we explore a topic that many of us face but struggle to understand. In today's episode, we'll be hearing from Sydney Grocott and Kristen Lou Byron. Both of my guests are registered social workers. Sydney comes to us from Hospice Aurelia, and Kristen is the founder of Growing in Grief, which provides grief counseling, support groups, education, and workshops. In today's episode, we will be discussing anticipatory grief. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
I'll let the two of you start by telling us what brought you to hospice.
Yeah. Kristen, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So in a little summarized version of it, what brought me to hospice was actually working alongside older adults. I was always drawn to, you know, sitting bedside, supporting residents and their loved ones when it comes to the end of life piece. And then I got this opportunity, this wonderful opportunity to be the manager of bereavement and supportive care at a local hospice in Hamilton. And I sort of haven't really looked back. So that's my summary of what brought me to hospice and a little bit about where I've been. Go ahead, Sydney.
Thanks. So from my experience, I've had some experiences with just some close family deaths, but one piece of it was being introduced to hospice at my hometown location in Chatham, Ontario. And that's where my grandma decided to die. And that was in 2019. And she had a beautiful death, I would say. And the location was beautiful. The volunteers there and staff support were just really incredible. So that always really stuck with me. At the time, I was not in social work. That wasn't my background. But I think that kind of really introduced end of life kind of conversations in my life. And I ended up going to university for social work, took some gerontology courses, and it really inspired me. So I was very lucky and fortunate to have Hospice Aurelia looking for a job opportunity. And I applied and I've been here for about a year and 3 months, and I love it. I really find a lot of meaning in this work.
Thank you. Both of those stories are amazing how you got into it. So today, our topic, anticipatory grief, can you explain to us what exactly that is?
Do you want to start with that one, Sydney?
Kristen probably has a better idea of maybe a closer kind of definition. I like to talk about the things that it's not, right? So anticipatory grief is not really truly the same as that after death grief, it can look different, and it looks different in regard to what we are grieving. I think the point of this podcast, Kristen, I are wanting to talk about is normalizing that there are differences, but they are also normalizing those experiences, I guess. So anticipatory grief, you know, that can come at the beginning of diagnosis, and that diagnosis could be years from now, or sorry, prognosis could be from years from now, but the beginning of that diagnosis of a life-limiting illness, that day could be the start of your grief as well, along with the other aspects of that. That might mean having to retire early. That might mean, you know, not being able to go on family vacations because you're ill, right? So these anticipating these losses is kind of how I view that word. Kristen, do you have a point of view from that?
Yes, and I think what a great job you just did, Sydney. So what I would say anticipatory grief is, and really this is just, you know, my definition, as Sydney just said, like her definition, everyone's going to have a varying interpretation, right? So I would say, you know, feelings of grief or loss that one may feel before, you know, the loss actually happens. And when I say that, I'm talking specifically about somebody dying. And somebody, and I think Sydney said this, like you can feel this anticipatory loss for years, for weeks, and for days. And it's, you know, almost one of those experiences. And maybe any of us or the listeners have experienced this, where you're going through it, you're feeling all these feelings, and you don't really have a name for it. So I think, in addition to normalizing, you know, talking about grief, really looking at how can we normalize also specifically anticipatory grief when people, you know, a lot of people feel it, but let's, you know, let's start naming it. And also I think, you know, though the focus is really going to be about the physical death, it's also, you know, anticipatory grief can be so many things. The feeling of grief or loss towards, you know, a big move coming up, the change of a job, right? So that's sort of my broad definition of anticipatory grief, Laurie. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add as well, some, you know, kind of conversations that I have with clients that are, say, caregivers of their loved one with life-limiting illness. And they are having these anticipations of what does my financials look like after my loved one passes? Perhaps that was the breadwinner of the family, or just, of course, just having from two incomes to one, having to move from a family home to a smaller unit. All these anticipations that come along with the grief in the future as well. I feel like it's a piece of how we protect ourselves, is looking forward to the future to protect ourselves and such. But it is very much as like active and physical symptoms as, you know, pre-death, or sorry, post-death grief.
Mm-hmm. And now that you said that, an idea has popped into my head, Sydney. It's that, you know, anticipatory grief, it could be for the individual living with, you know, a diagnosis, a terminal diagnosis, or it can very much be for the caregivers, your family, your friends, or your loved ones. And as social workers, oftentimes those are the people that we're supporting, both the family and the loved ones, as well as the person themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, so everybody, whether you have the one with the diagnosis or not, everybody feels anticipatory grief, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
So what do you think, so why is it important for the individual with life-threatening illness and their caregivers or family or friends to acknowledge their anticipatory grief?
Okay, so maybe I can start off with one and then we can continue to add to that. But it's, you know, normalizing the feeling or what it is, right? I think a lot of times, whether again it be for the individual or the loved ones, it's they're feeling or experiencing all of these emotions, whether it be, you know, anger, anxiety, sadness. and they just need a space or somebody to connect with to talk about it. And as social workers, part of our role is hearing, you know, sitting with them, hearing it, maybe providing counseling and letting them talk. And, you know, once they've opened up and shared how they're feeling, us being like, you know what? We hear, you know, what you're saying, and then just normalizing those feelings. And a lot of times, even in initial conversations that I've had with people, it's almost like you can hear them like breathe this, like, you know, a sigh of relief. Oh my gosh, like what I'm feeling, what I'm going through, it's a normal thing. Other people experience it as well.
Yeah, to tag on to that, I would just say, going back to the normalization, is a lot of people, because they don't talk about that anticipatory grief, a lot of caregivers and individuals with life-limiting illness, there's some sense of maybe not wanting to put that quote-unquote burden on others to talk about their grief. You know, sometimes the conversation is, well, why am I crying already? Like, my loved one is still here and with us. But it's normalizing that knowledge of what it means to have that diagnosis and that prognosis, no matter, like I said, you know, no matter if that's weeks to years, normalizing our feelings. And you're so right, Kristen. There's so much of that breath of fresh air to be like, okay, what I'm experiencing is normal. I think that it's not talked about enough. And who wants to experience that alone? Grieving can be, I wouldn't say maybe easier, but, you know, to have support with you and letting people know how you're feeling and what you're going through, to have the most support to lift you up and guide you on that path. I think that's beneficial for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like having, it's one of those tools I often say in your toolkit, right? Whether you're being normalized through counseling or therapeutic, or even, you know, a support group. Oftentimes, I myself have even facilitated anticipatory support groups, right? And although grief and the feelings that everyone feels, it's going to be unique and person-centered to them, they can, you know, sit in a support group and hear other people's stories and maybe relate to them more than somebody, you know. And it could even be their friend who is not able to, you know, support them in that capacity, like a support group, because it's never happened to them. They've never lived through, they don't have that lived experience, right? And maybe moving away from the normalization and moving more into this idea that of having these conversations, and maybe we can call them, you know, advanced care planning, right? That's also something else that social workers work alongside families and the individual. It's, you know, when you have this diagnosis, and maybe it's, you know, a cancer diagnosis, maybe it's Alzheimer's, maybe it's Parkinson's, ALS, the list can really go on. And you know it's a life-limiting diagnosis, right? Or you know that the medical team has said you have, you know, a year or less. It's one of the hardest, I think, things to hear as a human, right? And grief is so, so hard. And death is one of the most challenging, difficult human experiences. But I always try and, you know, educate and empower the people I work with to say, you know what? Let's sit with all of it and let's talk about what you value. What are your wishes? So maybe in this year or the 6 months that you have remaining, we can honor those wishes, right?
Did you have anything
to add, Sydney?
Yeah, I'm kind of envisioning, you know, like a kind of a therapy session in my brain of talking with a caregiver, and they are sharing their grief with me. And as beautiful as that is, I'm like, have you, you know, sit with that feeling, and have you shared that with your loved one? Have you shared how you feel and what your worries are with the individual with the life-limiting illness? Because maybe they're having the exact same experience, right? Maybe they're also scared, and maybe they're also having all these kind of grief feelings as well. And then that could open up that conversation of end of life conversation and trying to value talking about what our values and beliefs are, and trying to provide opportunities to honor the wishes of the individual with the life-limiting illness, right? Which could be, yeah, you know, some people are have worries or fears, anxiety about these end-of-life conversations, but they are extremely valuable, you know, as like I just said, to honor wishes, to make possibly a little bit more of a smoother transition. And yeah, normal, again, back to that normalization of anticipatory grief, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, oh my goodness, you that was such a wonderful, you know, addition, Sydney, because those conversations, I have the same ones with, you know, clients and families where they're telling me, they're unloading how they feel. And I'll ask that same thing, like, oh, like, did you communicate this? Did you share or talk about it with your person? And oftentimes it's like, no. And, you know, maybe their person, the person with the illness, where they're at in their own grief at that moment, it's not the right day, right? Or maybe it won't come. But for somebody, and, you know, maybe a family who it is going to work for, I encourage that conversation. And what comes out of it is you're really, it's like, ask all the questions, say all the things. So after the fact, especially if you're like the power of attorney and have all this, you feel like you have this extra like weight because you have to make decisions if a person is no longer, you know, capable of making those decisions. What do you want to ask your person? So you're not going to hold on to any of that guilt, right? Or what are you going to ask your person so you can give them, you know, a good death, that beautiful death that you had mentioned earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, going into it, it's, you get to do little projects. And I know one that I love that you guys do in the community is that life storybook, right? It's doing stuff like that, that you get to capture who the person is, you know, what makes them who they are. So I really think, you know, maybe summarizing this advanced care planning and the normalization, they're important pieces when it comes to anticipatory grief. Mm-hmm, do you think mm-hmm. there anything else we should add on, Sydney?
I feel like and this is maybe a good point to share, you know, my own kind of story in regards mm-hmm. to, again, kind of normalizing different experiences and such, you know, as a family member losing a parent. So when I was 16, my mom passed away, and I didn't realize in that moment until I got to hospice about this anticipatory grief, right? And so that was 11 years ago that she died, and I was going through all these motions, you know, all these grief symptoms, and felt pretty alone in that experience, and didn't think that was normal because my mom was still alive, right? And had this very short prognosis. And so, you know, to normalize those conversations so that caregivers, for family members, for kids, teenagers, you know, young adults, all of the people that are affected by it, so that they can all support one another. I think that's just so key, is to support each other in the experience of grief, whether that is pre-death or post-death. I just think that it's really important to, you know, validate those experiences, those feelings, get those questions answered if possible, and yeah, to not feel alone in your experience, not only, of course, as the individual with life-limiting illness, but like I said, the family members that are affected as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. Thanks. And thanks for sharing. You know, I've said this to you before, Sydney. Thanks for sharing your own, you know, story about your loss and your lived experience. Like, I think that's what makes you such a great social worker. You know, you got the education piece and you have the lived experience, right? And I think that's also something that when you're doing the work that we do, I always encourage like new social workers, right? Like, we have boundaries as social workers, but this work is heart-centered. It's compassionate work. So I think your clients trust you, you know, and you really go into depth talking to them. So sharing stories about yourself and your lived experience, I think that really builds the rapport and the relationship when working, you know, in death and dying and in hospice and community work.
I agree.
Yeah. And I guess one more point that I'll make that comes up a lot, and I think it's a great one to add, is that when people, you know, have maybe spent years or they've been really living this diagnosis, this terminal diagnosis or Alzheimer's, and because I work closely as well with the geriatric population, and in times you might hear dementia, it's like mini deaths, right? So there's a lot of anticipatory grief for Alzheimer's and all the other losses. But when you're working through so much of anticipating and then the loss actually happens, the person dies, a common thing that people feel, and they're very hesitant to share, is relief. Mm-hmm. And they almost are looking at me, and some people will say, and other people won't, and I'll almost be like, are you feeling, and then I'll initiate it, right? Because when somebody says, I'm like, I feel happy, or I feel glad, or I'm so relieved, it's not that they don't love their person any less, right? It's just maybe they've watched them, you know, they've watched their quality of life change so significantly. And for them, they feel relief that they're not in that physical pain anymore, right? And that's when I really take note of when I've been working closely with somebody with the anticipatory grief and then carried on afterwards. It's that, you know, normalizing that is normal too, a feeling of a relief. Yeah. And that's all for me.
Wow. Yeah. I can relate also with all of those points. And I think it is important for everyone to share their feelings. And even though you might think you're being a burden, you know, chances are you're not. You know, people that love you want to help you and want to get you through those times. So yeah, reaching out to, you know, anyone, your friends or family, is just so important when you're going through those things. So yeah, that was great. So what are your hopes and goals for the future of grief and bereavement services?
Oh, how long do we have for this one? Well, you start, Sydney.
The list is long, but
right?
A bit simple, and the blaring or glaring obvious ones I feel are just that connection of support, you know, like day one of diagnosis. I think that's a missing key. Is a lot of my clients, anyway, they come to me or are referred to me often when it's almost at their breaking point, either for, you know, as a caregiver with very close to caregiver burnout, or, you know, the individual with life-limiting illness is possibly weeks to months to less than a year. And I could have truly have been supporting them multiple years before that. And so the support of diagnosis and carrying it through to after death as well. I think that there, of course, there are rules and policies and procedures that we need to do in order to reach, you know, as many people as we can and to provide them as many supports as possible. But it really truly is complex in regard to how many people are involved in people's care, right? So, you know, one individual might see, you know, five or six people coming in and out of their house. And then on top of that, you know, with their social worker, and then, you know, their loved one passes, and then I move them to the bereavement and grief, which is separate from me. And so that's a whole other person. So it's just to decrease, you know, the need for complex, what is it? Not complex, but like to decrease the amount of confusing relationships. I feel like that is a possible answer. And then on top of that is reaching those communities that are not being reached. I think that's another missing piece for sure. I guess I don't have an extreme knowledge around that. It's just, you know, kind of an understatement to say that rural communities are not being reached for support as much as they possibly could. Those are my 2 points.
Yeah. And I feel like I couldn't have said it better myself. And, you know, if I'm looking at it, it's very much, you know, starting with what you said, it's people, like, my wish is that people, you know, and whether this is Ontario, Canada, or even worldwide, people know what is available in terms of support, right? Long before you've reached the point of caregiver burnout, long before, you know, the person has died. And this is not to say those are all important, right? So these are all important pieces, the grief and bereavement counseling, but really, you know, having access and the knowledge to the support and supports that are available from, you know, social workers to the support groups, or even something as simple as, you know, there's this notion that, or our society lives off of, you know, this discomfort when it comes to talking about death and dying as a whole, right? Anticipatory grief is just a piece of it, but the larger thing is death and dying. And when I do education seminars, like, one of the first things I say is, we are all going to die. As humans, that's the one thing that we share, right? So why don't we talk about it more? It's because it is uncomfortable, right? So my hope is that as a population, we, you know, engage in these difficult conversations, because whether it is talking about anticipatory grief or the grief and bereavement support and all of that, it's a conversation that is so important and so needed, because it will honor who we all are as people, and it will allow us all the best deaths, right? So that I feel is the big one for myself.
And a lot of what we talk about in the healthcare world, but specifically hospice, is just that self-care piece. I'm not sure what my hopes and goals are necessarily specifically regarding self-care, but, you know, normalizing self-care, not only, again, for the individual with life-limiting illness, but for their whole team, whether that looks like their caregivers, their family members, their friends, but also, of course, the team that provides them. That could be their nurses, their doctors, their social workers, the PSWs. Self-care around, you know, grief and death and bereavement and all that is so needed, so we don't burn out, and so that we can provide the quality of care that is deserved. Yeah, I think that is a conversation that has been going around in my year and 3 months at Hospice Aurelia, of just how do I take care of myself? How do I show up best for my clients? And how can I walk that path with my clients? And self-care doesn't need to be this beautiful, grandiose, glamorous kind of experience. It could be, what is self-care spiritually for me? What is self-care physically for me, mentally, and all that good stuff as well. So again, normalizing this, I think it's just, whether we're a caregiver or a social worker or a PSW, we want to do all the things and be everything for everyone in that sense, right? And so self-care kind of comes at the bottom of the totem pole, and that shouldn't be. That's all I gotta say.
I love how you talked about all the holistic pieces, right? Whether it's, what do we need emotionally, what do we need spiritually, maybe even like physically, all those things, right? That, again, that person-centered lens that we bring up, and self-care, you know, as social workers, it is one of those things that are from the get-go drilled into your education. And it's something that, you know, we introduce with the caregivers or our clients as appropriate. It's not like we're going to meet somebody and then go self-care, right? That could be triggering. It's what is appropriate. But then also for ourselves, right? I feel like that's it's a big gap. And how do we show up as the best version of ourselves as professionals, as social workers, as all the interdisciplinary team members, right, that Sydney mentioned? It is self-care. And really, it's something that I feel like every single person can do better, myself included, and just figuring out what that looks like, mm-hmm. I think is should be on all of our to-do lists.
And then honestly, it needs to come from a top-down approach, because it's true in regard to, you know, whether it's an 8-hour shift or a 12-hour shift or 24-hour shift, you know, it's hard to come home and do that work on our own hours of self-care, right? And trying to, you know, revitalize ourselves from just our work day. You know, in my opinion, it could really be interjected into our work hours. Of course, that looks different for different backgrounds and different services and organizations. But I think it's just, burnout is just so real. And, you know, what happens when we all burn out, right? The self-care is so needed, but if we don't have the time, energy to do it after hours, then how can we get that into our work day to show up best for ourselves and show up best for our clients? But like I said, I think that takes like an organization as a whole to do.
Great. That was beautifully said.
Yes. Self-care. Definitely. It's hard to fit it in, but you can, if, you know, it does work when you do take the time, and a lot of organizations now are, you know, really promoting that self-care aspect to their employees as well. So it is getting there and getting out there. Starting to anyways. So I guess that brings us to the end of today's episode on anticipatory grief. A heartfelt thank you to our incredible guests today for sharing their insights and personal experiences with us. You know, these insights and experiences shed light on such an important and often looked aspect of grief. So to our listeners, if you found today's discussion helpful, please consider sharing it with someone who might need it. Remember, it's okay to seek support, to talk about your feelings, especially when facing difficult transitions. So thank you to Sydney and Kristen for joining us today. And thank you to the listeners for listening to Beyond the Stethoscope.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.